I'm Dan Gibbons from the City Club, and it's an honor to have all of you here on... thanks for that. An honor to have you all here today. Happy snow day. I know we're all juggling children, kids, and schools and all the fun stuff that comes with that. So we appreciate everyone being here today. We always at City Club gather just an incredible and diverse array of people from various sectors. And, you know, Jackie mentioned our sponsors. We couldn't do it without all of your support. And just the people that are in this room are what make up City Club. As she said, it's your club. And, you know, we just use this platform to share it with all of you. And we gather an amazing group of business and civic and, you know, government leaders. And a sampling of that today, as we always like to do, we're honored to be joined by the Council General of Ireland. Brian Cahalane is here. Council General, thank you. Adele Simmons is here, a wonderful civic leader who's done so much for our great city. David Griesing is here from Better Government and Better VGA. Thank you, David. Sandy Rand is here. Sandy, another Chicago civic legend, as is Sarah Garza Resnick, doing all sorts of great work. Where are you, Sarah? Okay. What a great, I always like to do that just to show there's this really neat, unique diversity. We have a number of students in the room and future leaders. If you're a future leader, okay, how about this? If you're a student, raise your hand. And we're going to, what we're really trying to do, Loyola has been, and also UIC, DePaul, there are a number of universities, University of Chicago, that have kind of taken notice what we're doing here to gather some younger folks and help lift them up and make them part of the conversation, because that's the future, right? So we want to incorporate them into the conversation, understand what's on their minds, what their questions are. So I hope you've got a couple good questions ready from our young men at Loyola. So thank you for indulging me in all of that. We have an incredible panel today. There's so much to discuss that I'm just going to hand it right over and let the experts do their thing. Not that anyone really knows what's going on these days, but we're joined by so many great experts. I forgot to mention one of those experts. Joan Coogan is also in the room. Joan, long time City of Chicago, Chicago Park District, you name it. She's made such an impact on our city. So if I could invite the panelists to come on up and join us. And I'm not going to introduce each one of them. I'll let Sylvia do that in a second when we're all set. But I also will mention that Brian Johnson is really responsible for pulling all this together. Like I say, it's your club. Brian came to me with this idea. We said, let's do it tomorrow, and figured, okay, let's maybe give it a week. But thank you, Brian, for that. And I'm going to hand it over here to Sylvia Garcia. Sylvia, who so many of you know from the Chicago Community Trust, she's our chief operating officer. And the trust, as you know, touches so many of these different issues. And this is just one conversation we're going to have. There's so much more to come. There's one tomorrow, actually, at dinner. There's going to be another one in a couple weeks. And there's so much more to come. So thank you all for being here. Thank you to our experts for agreeing to do this in this ever-changing environment. Welcome all you to City Club, and a special welcome to Sylvia Garcia from the Community Trust. Thanks. And get those questions ready. Later on, we will bring them up to Sylvia, or I'll be able to hand a microphone around. So please come with some good questions. Thanks.
Thank you. Great to be here. Glad so many people are true Chicagoans and were able to weather the snow. So glad to see everybody. I'm going to do a very quick intro, mainly just name and title of the other folks on the panel so we can jump into things. But I'm really excited to be here on behalf of the Chicago Community Trust and help moderate this discussion. To my right is Jennifer Walling, who's the Executive Director of the Illinois Environmental Council, and she's been in that role since 2011. Next to Jennifer is Mary Meg McCarthy, who is the executive director of the Heartland Alliance. No longer Heartland Alliance. I'm like,
where's Dan?
Wrong bio. Sorry. Executive director of the National Immigrant Justice Center, which is one of the nation's leading immigration and human rights advocacy organizations. And then Brian C. Johnson has served as the CEO of the LGBTQ civil rights organization Equality Illinois since 2016. So we're very excited to have this group of folks. I think each member of this panel really has great depth in their field of interest and field of study and field of work that they're working on. And for us at the Chicago Community Trust, we're really focused on how do we work together as a city to bring all of those different sectors, those industries together to help people prosper in Chicago. We are the community foundation for the city of Chicago. We're 109, almost 110 years old. And so the theme for us is always how do we make Chicago better and how do we bring Chicagoans together? So really excited to be a part of this panel and have that conversation. So I'm going to start with just a quick, for folks in the room that don't know your organization and the work that you do, what's a quick one-minute elevator pitch of what's the work that you do, and then how has that work changed in the last few weeks?
The Illinois Environmental Council advocates on behalf of over 130 environmental organizations throughout the state of Illinois, building power for people and the environment. We advocate at all sorts of levels of government, and right now just connecting the chaos of the federal funding, protecting our workforce, have been new challenges that we're facing going ahead that's been new work.
Good afternoon. Thank you to all of you for being here to be part of this panel. The National Immigrant Justice Center provides legal support to immigrants, refugees, and asylum seekers. And we draw on our direct legal services to advance systemic reform through litigation, advocacy, and communications. We are more than 40 years old, 41 years now, I think, and we have 160 colleagues, lawyers, paralegals, and professionals with five offices throughout the country. Our world has been turned upside down, as you can imagine. The cruelty and inhumanity that we're seeing is just really appalling, impacting many of my colleagues in the office who come from the impacted communities that we're seeing. Day two, I think January 22nd, we received a stop work order from the administration telling us to stop providing legal services at the immigration court. At 3 o'clock in the afternoon, we had to have our staff come back from the immigration court where they were serving a large, large number of people. They were traumatized, and the individuals in the immigration system were looking for us all over the place saying, what happened to those lawyers? It was really traumatizing. Luckily, the following week, February 3rd, thanks to intervention of the federal court in Rhode Island, that stop work order was temporarily rescinded. So we were able to go back and continue our work. But that just shows you the first thing he was going after was defunding legal services to the immigrant community. Subsequently, we've been very engaged in monitoring and representing and providing legal services to individuals who are caught up in the raids. They were significantly reduced, the numbers of people who were caught. However, those who were picked up, many of them suffered from various human rights and constitutional right violations. We are now exploring those violations in terms of following through with some litigation. We are representing some of the individuals in their immigration proceedings, and I can talk a little bit about that later. Thank you.
Thank you.
Sylvia, you said elevator pitch, so I'm going to assume I can do a Willis Tower.
Sure, yes. Yeah.
So first, a couple of thank yous. I just want to thank all the workers here at Maggiano's for making it possible for us to gather. And I try never to take this stage without making sure we are all really clear about the critical work that Dan, Jackie, and the entire City Club team do to bring the most cutting-edge, innovative, relevant topics to discussion here. I know for me and for most of us in the city, when we want to grapple with something new and hard and something we have to understand, this is one of the first places we want to be. So thank you for doing that. And thank you to my panelists. Silvio, the position the trust holds in this city is remarkable. And the stewardship you all take for care of the city is great. And Jen and Mary Meg are just rock stars in their own fields, but two people that I have learned incredibly from over the past decade. So thank you. So Equality Illinois is the state's LGBTQ plus civil rights organization. We do four things. One, we advance pro-LGBTQ plus public policy on the state and local level, with a particular focus on the areas our community is most impacted: healthcare, criminal justice, and economic justice. Two, we advance people into positions of public leadership with a specific focus on state boards and commissions and running for office. Three, we work to build power of queer organizations around the state. And four is we work to strengthen the ecosystem of LGBTQ plus organizations. Mm-hmm. Like, I can't tell you what the world is going to look like 10 years from now, honestly, let alone 10 minutes from now. But the bet that we take at Equality Illinois is that if we have the best laws that protect and affirm us, if we are in every single room where decisions are made about our community, if we are powerful in every neighborhood we call home, and if our organizations have the resources they need to solve our biggest problems, there's nothing we can't accomplish. And I think it's one of the reasons that Illinois is one of the, if not the most pro-LGBTQ plus equality states in the country. Since January 20th, I'll just say for context, the current president and his allies spent $215 million on ads targeting the trans community. That actually is only equaled to the ads targeting the immigrant community. So we are very clear that this president rode to power on the backs of immigrants and trans folks. So we expected what we're seeing now. And in short, we're seeing almost a half dozen executive orders that seek to really use trans folks, trans adults, and in particular trans kids, as the canary in the coal mine to go after so many of the things we hold dear in this city. The impact in the short run has been very narrow, and we'll talk about that. But I think what we're also seeing is the impact of real fear of what does it look like to see the highest office in the land come after your identity or to come after your kid, and watching wonderful, in many cases, wonderful allies back away and comply in advance because they're so afraid of not what is happening, but what might happen to them. And those are the two things that we're struggling with the most right now.
Thanks, Brian. That's really helpful context. And I think a lot of folks are here in the room because they're concerned members of Chicago, right? And I think, to me, that's what I'd really love for us to get into a little bit more today, right? It's all about the human element, right? Mm-hmm. And I think there's also this sense of fear and not knowing what's really going on and what's happening. And I think a lot of folks, when you think federal government, you're like, oh, that's that thing over in D.C. that's far away. That doesn't really impact me. But we're seeing it really impact folks' day-to-day life right now. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's been really hard and difficult to kind of even keep track of all the things that are happening or being threatened or all of those things kind of coming together. How are each of you really keeping your finger on the pulse of like what's happening nationally and how does that relate to Chicago? So are there things that folks in the room, I had a member of my team come to me and say like, I'm getting all my news from TikTok, which made me kind of a little nervous that maybe there's some good stuff, some bad stuff, not sure what's there. So are there things that you would recommend for folks that are concerned citizens that want to understand this? You know, this discussion is an opportunity for us to bring that out. But are there resources or other things that folks in this room should be thinking about as they're trying to stay abreast of all the things that are happening?
I really think people have to make sure that they are getting their information from credible sources. There is so much misinformation out there, and that is also creating fear in the communities. I think we're very fortunate here in Chicago to have an excellent media that is really going into the communities, talking to experts about what is going on. And we have found that to be a great source for us, as well as obviously national news. But it's really trying to find out what's happening here locally. Where is ICE? What are they doing? Who is facing what in their communities? And we also have a really good website, immigrantjustice.org, that has done an analysis of the executive orders and what's happening. I'll give you one quick example. There was rumors that what's called the U visa or trafficking visa or VAWA, Violence Against Women Act visa, had been terminated. That has not yet happened, and we hope it doesn't happen. But that information created so much fear in the communities that our Know Your Rights materials had to be revised to be able to address that. Venezuelan TPS is being terminated for certain groups, not all groups of Venezuelans. That information's on our website, but that kind of information is really important, that it's accurate and people have access to lawyers who can provide that counsel.
I wish I had a great answer on that. And I do think the Sun-Times in particular and the Tribune have been doing really good work on this. I know they're not our paper of record. I think the New York Times has been doing great. In particular, I've learned an incredible amount from Ezra Klein, both his podcast and what he writes. I think it's been really critical. We also try to stay really close to the great works on the front, great groups on the front line, groups that are trans-led, trans-serving. So groups like Chicago Therapy Collective, groups like Brave Space Alliance, Life is Work, Task Force Prevention and Community Services, the Transformative Justice Law Project of Illinois. We try to stay really close to our partners there. And then we try to push things out as much as possible. The challenge that we face, and I'm sure you all face it too, it is moving so quickly that I always worry that the moment we put something out, 10 minutes later, it's not going to be the accurate truth. And right. So we, honestly, I don't have a great answer. We're struggling with how to do that. It's one of the reasons we have eschewed putting things on our website that stay up and tried to do more things like Zoom convenings and gatherings like that, where we can give people live information. So. Mm-hmm.
And I think in looking at the impacts of this on the environment, I'll go into some agency stuff a little later. You know, we're looking at the biggest climate change legislation ever passed in federal history, the Inflation Reduction Act, being rolled back by executive order. So a piece where legislative action is being attacked by executive order. So it's tough to get the right information on all of this. And much as Brian said, we're keeping with our members that are on the ground. We're hearing individual stories. We're hearing where their federal grants might be impacted. We're hearing from municipalities. We've met with most of the state agencies to figure out the status of money. And, you know, it's still even the state agencies are dealing with a spectrum of knowledge of what is known and what is unknown and what is definitely canceled. So it's just a huge spectrum we're dealing with. So I think, you know, staying on the ground, listening to those news sources is a great way. But I think beyond, we're talking about credible news sources, right? And we're seeing also the decimation of environmental data on the federal level again. And this is stuff that very often the data and research that we can't get back. I know there are a lot of people who are diligently working to download data and information to make sure that we have it. But just getting rid of that. And for us, environmental justice and environmental justice community is super important. We're going to get to more agency items later as well. But just getting rid of environmental justice data that might be critical to track the health of particular communities. So all of those things are happening right now. And I think it is going to have to be a major challenge to figure out how to keep up with this. But I always say, even with state or city government, there's a lot of government that is made to be inaccessible to the public. Mm-hmm. And the federal government is made to be confusing for the individual to access. And I find it to be my job, and I know my panelists here find it to be their job, to open up government so that people can understand how best to access. So, and we're, I don't know the answer about how best to access federal government right now, but I know we're working on that, working on targeted tools. So we're using exactly what we need to get the best results, but that's 50% of all of our jobs in some ways, mm-hmm. making that accessible.
That's great. But no, I think that's really important. And one of the things we're really spending a lot of time at the Trust is just hearing from folks, right? Like sharing that information as best we can with each other, because it is changing and evolving so much. I think one of the things that you were talking about with, you know, the data, I think I spent almost a decade in D.C. working on the federal budget process. And I think so to me, that's a place where there was transparency in like the annual appropriations process and some of these other things that happen on a regular basis. But I think now we're seeing huge swings, right, in federal funding and what's happening and what's not happening there. And I think that relating it back to Chicago piece is really important, right? So I think when we had the spending freeze come across and say they're freezing all federal funding, I think folks are like, oh, that'll be really bad for people who get benefits, which it is. It's really terrible for vulnerable populations, but it also means money for cops. It means money for Head Start. It means money for Meals on Wheels. It means money for so many things like roads and bridges. Another former life of mine is working at the Chicago Transit Authority. And so how much of the money that keeps this city moving actually comes from the federal government is huge. And how much of the money that the city and state use to operate are really, really critical. So I think for me, that's something that's really keeping me up at night as I think about trying to drive Chicago to a city that's prospering and how we come together as Chicagoans is really being aware of the implications of any kind of stop in funding from the federal government for Chicago or for Illinois has repercussions for all of us. So I would love for each of you to maybe talk a little bit about what's keeping you up at night of all the things you've seen and kind of how do you really talk about those specific examples of what's happening in Chicago and like who's being impacted and why should Chicagoans matter or care about this? Why does it matter?
I mean, I have a rule that I break 4 out of every 5 nights, which is don't read the news after 9 o'clock.
me too. And it doesn't work.
I don't know why I don't listen to myself. You know, what has actually been impacted by the executive orders right now concretely is very little. And we are reminding people most of these executive orders, in our space at least, are press releases dressed up as laws, right? They are directing agencies to come up with rules or saying they're going to do something. But for the most part, they're not. Now, there are really critical ways, right? They have direct authority over the issuing of federal identity documents like passports, where incarcerated individuals are detained in immigration centers and prisons. They have authority about, you know, maybe have authority about military service and who or cannot serve. I think that's an open question. But, you know, access to facilities in federal buildings. Those are things that there's more of a direct line. Everything else is nothing yet. So in the long run, I deeply worry about LGBTQ plus people, in particular trans folks, being sidelined in their healthcare and in schools in particular and possibly in the workplace. And by the way, just an example of what's not true. Who here in this room believes that the president of the United States can determine who plays on kids' sports teams? Right? I mean, this is just an example of how so much of this is theater. But what keeps me up at night for the next 3 to 4 months is our partners who are complying in advance. Yes. So I'm going to give you an example, and it's a hard example. I'm going to give you an example of what's happening at Lurie Children's. Lurie Children's is remarkable. What they have done to provide evidence-based, life-saving, gender-affirming care is unparalleled. And there are thousands of young people that are alive today because of their courage and their willingness to meet the needs of people that other medical providers turned around. And last week, they announced that they were going to stop serving certain trans kids with certain procedures. And they agreed, when I spoke with them, that they are making healthcare decisions about trans kids unrelated to their health needs, and they're doing so before a single law has been changed. Now, the risks to groups like Lurie's is immense, right? So much, I imagine, I don't know their finances, but so much comes from the finances come from the federal government. I am not saying that that threat isn't imminent, but I am also saying that the threat isn't here yet. And I think what's going to crush us in the next couple of weeks is that hospital who says, you know, we're going to help most kids, but I think these 20 we're willing to sacrifice for the moment. Or that school district that says, you know, we'll teach most of the inclusive curriculum law, but we're just not going to talk about trans people in history, right? Or that employer that says, you know, we're totally going to honor our trans employees, but we're not going to let them use this bathroom just yet because the threat could be there. I think that is the greatest risk. And what is hard to say, because I am saying it to the allies who have been with us the most over the years, is you can't do that in advance. Do not comply in advance. We don't know what will end up being blocked. We don't know what will end up being made into law. And by signaling early willingness to sacrifice your students or your patients or your workers, you are not only possibly breaking the law, you are not only harming the people closest to you, you are sending a signal to an entire community about how quickly you will fold. And that is heartbreaking.
Thank you, Brian. Thank you.
Yeah, and so much that keeps me up at night. But I think the thing that I am most worried about in all of this, and I'm going to end up with what doesn't keep me up at night, too, just a positive. But what keeps me up at night are the items that can be affected that we'll never get back. So I think, you know, there are definitely people's health and people's lives that, you know, if you are drinking water that is polluted and it impacts your life for the rest of your life, if you lose your life because of some action. But also I think about our preserved natural spaces that preserve natural lands throughout the country that have never been touched. And you know, this administration can just go in and drill. They can just go in and destroy that property, something that's been around longer than humanity has, and just destroy it. Just to take pleasure in that and see that as progress and making America great is just so disgusting to me. And so those are the things that keep me up at night, because that's just a, you know, we're just one small action away from some of those things happening. And you can move forward with it, and then you're not going to get it back later when there's some legal action. So anything that is done in that way, that's a piece that is keeping me up at night. And I am absolutely concerned about the federal government moving away from any climate action. You know, they've erased climate already from US EPA websites. They're not working on these anymore. But I think the piece that doesn't keep me up at night, I mean, I am devastated by the future of the Inflation Reduction Act, our biggest climate change legislation ever. And we'll see incentives rolled back. We'll see grants that don't happen, et cetera. But, you know, I'm relying a bit on, there's this University of Maryland study that says that 40 to 65% emission reductions can be achieved by 2035 by non-federal actors. So I think that we really have to place a lot of hope in our states and the other states that have committed to 100% renewable energy to get there. And also the private sector. I am not as devastated in that area because I see the private sector heading there. I know there's things that can happen to be awful. Let's build new coal plants. But that's such a bad investment. And everybody in the private sector knows it. So those are the things that don't keep me up at night, that I have hope we're not going to quite get where we would with the federal government, but let's outpace them. And I'm really proud of our governor, J.B. Pritzker, in his climate leadership. He has been ahead of governors in the country. There's
There's places where I want him to race to the top because there's a couple areas we could do better for sure. But I am rooting for our governor to race to the top, not only on climate, environment, nature-based solutions, but all of our issues. It's more important than ever.
Well, big picture wise, I stay up at night worrying about our democracy. Yeah. I just feel like it's just so fragile. And I'm hopeful so far with the courts and how they have responded. But I fear what's going to happen as it goes all the way up to the Supreme Court. It's just such a big unknown in terms of how they're going to interpret how much authority the executive branch has. But in our day-to-day work, I stay up at night about our ability to continue our services. We receive public funding. I told you a small part that was had a temporary stop work order. But we do a lot of other services that, you know, after years of advocacy, we've been able to get federal dollars, especially to represent unaccompanied immigrant children and families. And it's a vital lifeline to people. And if we lose that funding, it's going to have serious repercussions, both on our staff that have poured their heart and soul into the work and the possibility of loss of jobs, and to the community that has really depended on our legal services to provide them with safety and to keep their families together. If they lose access to legal counsel, they cannot really effectively navigate and complicated and becoming even more complicated immigration court system or immigration system for that matter. We would be sending people back to their home countries where they'd be persecuted. We would be separating permanently families. We would be denying ourselves the richness of an immigrant community that has such an impact on this city, on this state, on this country. We would see people losing work authorization. They would no longer be able to work. They would no longer be able to fully participate and contribute to our society. It would impact consumers, it would impact the workforce. These are values as a country that we cherish, and I fear that we may lose some of that.
Thank you, Mary Meg. I think I'd love to stay on that topic a little bit more. It's sobering to kind of think about all of those repercussions, and you know, I think we've been hearing about folks being afraid to leave their homes and not go to work and really not know how to navigate this current situation. And I know NIJC has done a ton of work on Know Your Rights and trying to inform people on kind of how to navigate. But I think the part that I want to point out to this group is that's heartbreaking and difficult for those individuals. And that's something that those are folks that are our neighbors, that are important members of our communities. But there's also an economic toll, right, in a lot of that work. And so, you know, I think we've heard recently that, you know, on 26th Street, I don't know how many folks are familiar, but 26th Street is the most economically important corridor in our city other than Michigan Avenue. Right. And so folks have been not going to work or not shopping there or not being there. And so that actually has repercussions for our tax revenue, our economy, all of those other elements of kind of what's happening. And so that there's some real cost to us as a city. So it's about the human piece, but there's also kind of that economic piece that's really, I think, critical for all of us to think about and know about. You know, I think things as simple as, you know, we're all in a restaurant right now. Think of your favorite restaurant, and there may be a day where it doesn't exist because they don't have the workers to be able to make those things happen. Mm-hmm. So just want to kind of provide that context for folks about that direct, how does it affect me, even if I'm not an immigrant or a member of an immigrant family. So just staying on that topic, I know the city and the state have a long history of being sanctuary cities, and would love for you to talk a little bit about kind of the recent, I think just last week, it's time is irrelevant to me, so it might have been yesterday, but I think it was last week. The Justice Department sued the state, the city, and the county over our sanctuary laws. And so would really love for you to talk a little bit about what those are for all of us and kind of what impacts do you see kind of happening there?
Okay. Excuse me. Yes. So the city of Chicago passed a welcoming city ordinance. I think it was under Harold Washington's tenure that it was initially passed and subsequently has continued to be supported and expanded, as well as the Illinois Trust Act, which was passed under a Republican governor. So both of these pieces of legislation are bipartisan and have been recognized as how we're making our community safer by these laws. And what they do is they prohibit local law enforcement from cooperating with ICE enforcement operations. And why does that make us safer? Well, if I'm an undocumented immigrant, I'm not going to want to call the fire department if my house is on fire. I am not going to go to the police and if I am a victim of domestic violence, or go to the police should there be some type of gang activity, because I'd be afraid I would be deported. So these laws make all of us safer as a community. So the Department of Justice filed a lawsuit against the city, the county, and the state. This is a lawsuit that they filed under the first Trump administration against San Francisco. And guess what? They lost. It's very similar. And I'm happy to say the city of Chicago also successfully defeated a similar lawsuit that tried to condition federal funding on cooperation with ICE enforcement. And thanks to Corporation Counsel successfully fighting that, that was defeated all the way up to the Seventh Circuit. So I feel like we're in a really good position, and we have an attorney, Illinois Attorney General, and the City of Chicago Corporation Counsel that will be able to challenge this in court, and hopefully we will see that our laws are protected. It's really interesting how this is all played out with the federal government, because what the federal government, I mean, they can still do their enforcement operations. They're just not getting cooperation, right? And they still have access to databases with information regarding individuals who are undocumented, who are in the criminal legal system. So there's nothing to stop them, but what they want to do is shift the burden on all of us as taxpayers. And that is not only wrong, but endangers all of us.
Thank you. Brian, you talked a little bit about kind of real impacts versus theatrics. Yeah. And how that's been a huge theme. Could you talk a little bit more when you say that, what you mean and kind of what are those? You talked a little bit about Lurie's and others, but what are those real impacts to the LGBTQ plus community? And how can, you know, all of us in this room, folks that are allies, really help in this moment?
Thank you. And I'm constantly evolving kind of how I'm talking about this to be even more precise, because I think instead of saying real impact and theatrics, I think I would say concrete impacts or direct impacts and indirect impacts. Because the fear that families have is real. And that harm is real, even if the source of that harm is an executive order that has little teeth at this point. So again, I think what we're seeing here in the short run, I think we're seeing, very little, just the direct stuff that the federal government can actually control. I think in the long run, I mean, just to say what is really at risk here is, we're looking at if this federal government can decide it can veto a parent's decisions about what medically appropriate care they can offer for their child. It is not like they're stopping at gender-affirming care. Right? This means they're going to seek to have that veto power over whether or not you can vaccinate your child, whether or not you can get your teenage child birth control and the like. Right? If they can decide or push to decide who plays in sports, I know this sounds hyperbole, but I promise it is a natural flow to empower school districts to demand genital checks for any child before they decide to play on the sport. Right? I mean, we are looking at if they can decide whether or not our curriculum is appropriate, it is going to empower the federal government to really pour through tons and tons of local and state curricula to confirm it matches their reactionary ideology. Right? So this is not just trans folks. When I say trans folks are the canary in the coal mine, right? This is what they're using to give themselves broad and expansive and new powers so that they can then use that as a foundation to come after everybody else. So I think what can you do is, you know, I am 47 years old, so I like to say that I'm losing my hair because I keep pulling it out. But if you want me to pull my hair out among the fastest ways possible is for somebody to tell me, well, we don't do trans stuff. Right, we don't focus on LGBTQ plus issues. LGBTQ plus issues are everywhere, right? So if you are a foundation or corporation who's focused on social impact or the social good in your community, you need to be asking the question, where are we on the LGBTQ plus stuff of these issues? I am not asking foundations to set up, for example, corporations to set up new priority areas. But if you are focused on healthcare, you need to be asking, how are we supporting the trans community at this time and trans-led organizations? If you are focused on education, the same thing. If you are focused on the racial wealth gap, right, the same thing, right? We do not exist as a silo. Like, queer and trans folks are part of every community, and we are harmed and disproportionately impacted in economic justice, healthcare, criminal justice, public violence, housing insecurity, everything. So if you are at a foundation or a corporation, I want you to go back to your offices and say, without changing a single priority, tell me where are we on the trans and queer dimension of the work that we do. I think that is absolutely critical. Number two, don't let institutions comply in advance. And I may only have a narrow window to say this, right? But don't force queer and trans folks to be the only people sticking up for themselves, right? If you have a relationship with your school district, you have a relationship with your medical provider, and you think they are waffling, call them and tell them it is important to you that they comply up until the absolute very last moment with the Illinois laws that we have in protecting community, right? And number three, just stand up for queer-led and queer-serving organizations and your neighbors. I was going to say like it was a separate organization. I couldn't remember. It was actually the City Club. So I got a phone call on Friday from the City Club saying, we want to make sure that some trans leaders from the community and trans-led organizations are in this room. Could you help us with that? And it was one of the first times in the past couple of weeks that a non-queer, non-trans organization had reached out to me and said, I'd like to proactively center queer and trans voices. Can you help me? And it was remarkable. So I think the more people can be doing that is helpful. So I think those are the three things, right? Focus on the queer and trans dimensions of the work you already do and push your organizations to do that. Use the relationships you have to put pressure on the institutions you have relationships with to not comply in advance. And do your best to stand up for and let queer and trans folks know that they are seen.
Thank you. So, Jennifer, kind of thinking about how this is impacting folks here on the local level, right? We've heard a lot about federal workforce and having the federal workforce shrinking currently in a number of different executive orders and actions that have been happening. And, you know, I don't know if folks know, but the federal government is actually the second largest employer in the state of Illinois after the state of Illinois. Mm-hmm. So a lot of those federal workers are your neighbors, people in this room, others. So there's kind of that human element of what's happening with the federal workforce. But I think part of the whole conversation about reducing the workforce relates back to policy and what agencies are able to do. And so recently, the Tribune reported that the new administration is moving to fire or force out more than 20% of the Environmental Protection Agency's Chicago staff. And that includes, as you were kind of alluding to, officials who enforce clean water and clean air laws. So I would love for you to kind of talk a little bit more about what are the practical effects of this and kind of what does this mean for all of us who live in the Chicago region?
Yeah. And I just want to start maybe just a moment of applause for our federal workers. Mm-hmm. Just... There are so many stories and so many ways that our federal workers are standing in front and refusing to leave their jobs when they've been even offered a payout. I want to, especially from our perspective, I work very closely with USEPA, AFGE, Local 704, which is the union for USEPA here in Chicago. And they are standing up loud and talking about what is happening in the office, which is devastating. We're already at 16% fewer employees than we were 25 years ago at USEPA. And right now, if these proposed cuts come forward, or proposed layoffs come forward, we'll be at 800 employees at USEPA, which is where we were at the end of the first Trump administration. So we're starting when we ended with the Trump administration, and just devastating. And not to mention, you know, along with all of the DEI things that have happened with grants, et cetera, they have already placed on administrative leave all the environmental justice employees everywhere. I think there are 20 in the Chicago office and over 100 throughout. We are not going to acknowledge the disproportionate impact and the cumulative impact of pollution on Black and Brown communities anymore at the federal level. And that has been even so critical within our state to pollution decisions as, you know, the federal government has come down and been like, you have to enforce these provisions, and they've put pressure on our IEPA to sometimes do the right thing. Just huge, huge challenges. And then I have just, you know, there's 20% of the workforce is retirement eligible. Those are going to be replaced by junior employees. And then all of these threats, whether it's RIFs or layoffs or administrative leaves, like so many of them are not legal. And so, you know, whether these will actually take place are going to be a question, but just like props to all those workers staying there. And that's just the numbers. I mean, the impact of this is Flint, Michigan. You know, the impact of this is serious environmental disaster that nobody is looking at and continues to happen, despite that, you know, somebody's doing it on purpose. Somebody's moving it forward. They know they can get away with it. And it impacts our health. It, you know, can be something that might kill people. It might serve with long-term damage. It will definitely serve corporations that want to pollute our air, land, and water. So these workers are really standing up for justice right now, and we got to work to keep them in place. The other threat, of course, is our IEPA is very much federally funded, and if there are cuts that are coming from the federal government, we're already facing a $3 billion budget shortfall on the state level. So making sure that our IEPA is fully funded, which we're also at 50% of the staff that we were 20 years ago within IEPA, IDNR. So it's just this policy of let's break it and then say it doesn't work. And that's what we're going to do to our state agencies, really concerning. And, you know, one thing you can all do, and especially students in the room, find jobs in government. And I mean, I know right now it's really like devastating to watch these things, and you maybe don't want to be there, but like we need really good people in these agencies implementing our law over time. And it might not always be like this, and maybe you'll get to do transformational things, but at least now you can be the person that is stopping some injustice from happening to a community in that role. So encouraging our networks to go work for government, even though it is not transformational in the right way right now.
I'm sorry to sneak in here. So much to cover, but thanks for that quick transition and allowing me to jump in, because I do want to go off script a little bit. We have about 4 minutes, maybe five. And if you'll allow me to have one of our students from Loyola ask a question that then can maybe help us close out a little bit. We may go 1 or 2 minutes over. But I'm going to walk this microphone over We don't usually do this at City Club, and I feel like a game show host.
No, this is very Oprah.
Yeah,
sorry,
I like
guys.
It.
But I know these. I know some of these students have really thought this through, and like I said, are you know future leaders. And so I'd like to ask one of you who has prepared a question just to step up and mention who you are and ask your question.
You got it. Did you have one?
Hello. My name is Miguel Abad Juarez. I'm a senior at Loyola. And first of all, thank you so much to each and one of you, because it's extremely, extremely important that leaders like you come and speak so that we know that there are people that are fighting for us. And especially, my question goes out to Ms. McCarthy. With everything going on to the undocumented community, to everything going on to the Latino community, what is something that they can look forward to?
I think right now what you can look forward to and what the community can look forward to is a lot of support. You see that from elected officials mm-hmm. such as Governor Pritzker, mm-hmm. Mayor Johnson, Cook County President Preckwinkle, like those are leaders, and everyone in this room and beyond. Tom Homan said, Chicago's educated. They're impeding our ability to do this enforcement because people are out there doing Know Your Rights presentations. And this is a community of people who care. And we are going to invest in our immigrant communities because that's what makes this country, that's what makes this state, this city, such a rich one.
I think we got two more minutes. Here you go.
Hi, my name's Kevin Nguyen. I'm a graduate student at Loyola Social Work. I'm studying migration as well. First off, thank you to City Club as well as the panelists for being here. We really appreciate you taking the time out of your very busy days, I imagine, to be with us. A question I also have for Ms. Meg McCarthy is, so I'm on staff at Loyola. I support our undocumented mixed status and DACA students on campus. Do you have any guidance on how we as faculty, staff, and allied students can support them? Currently, our center is inviting in a lot of Know Your Rights groups. Mm-hmm. So NIJC, mm-hmm. Vanessa Esparza-Lopez, thank you.
Yes.
And also a lot of red cards. Do you have any other specifics that you would recommend for higher ed at this time?
Know Your Rights, and hopefully people have had some type of legal screening to see if they are eligible for anything. That's really, really critical. Individual assessments have become much more necessary so that people who are eligible for some type of relief are able to pursue that relief. But those who are not, don't file a case or an application that would put them in front of this government. So I think that's what I would recommend right now. Continue to get the support from Loyola and all the universities and academic institutions. That is going to be critical. It goes back to what my colleague here said, I'm blanking, Brian said, you know, we can't, like, proactively say, oh, we're not going to allow undocumented students in our school because we could be at risk by the federal government. I mean, that would be so harmful and undermining mm-hmm. the academic institution's mission. So we have to hold on to what is currently our rights and our laws to provide protection and access mm-hmm. to healthcare, education, shelter, and safety to all individuals in our communities.
I'll hand it back to you if you'd like to close out and with any final thoughts or just a quick thank you. I'll thank you for allowing me to interrupt there.
Oh, that was great. I think that's great. I mean, the only question I had left was really kind of trying to galvanize and ask everybody, you know, we're a city that likes to roll up our sleeves and do work. Is there one quick thing that we can jam in here? I think you've already said some, but like, what's one quick thing that you think I will start with? To me, I think it's been a time where we need to lean into our community. And I think at the Trust, we're trying to think about how we bring people together and have conversations, but like acknowledging each other's humanity and really connecting with people, to me, I think is a huge part. I don't know if any.
Yeah. I want to, on that, the first student's question, I want to hear from leaders like you. I want, you know, students to step up, and you guys are already, your voices are being heard. I want you to tell us where we need to be stronger and more proactive. And I want all of us talking to our government officials to ensure we're all supporting people doing the right thing, to continue to do the right thing. And sometimes it's not going to be enough, but, you know, praising where and when we can. But, you know, getting involved, like I said, I want to hear from you guys as leaders.
And I think I started off by, we had a question about this. I think it's really important that people stay informed and share that information, accurate information, and recognize our elected leaders who are doing the right thing. Let them know that this is right. This is what we believe in. So they're not hanging out there alone. And then I think supporting legal services is just critical more than ever before, that if we can get people protection, legal protection, our communities will be much safer. Thank you.
I think I already gave my 3-point call to action, so I'll just end with a thank you. Sylvia, thank you for moderating this panel, for my incredible panelists, and for each of you to come out as, you know, what looks like winter, but I just think is a regular old Chicago day. It shows your deep commitment to the city, to the communities we care about, and I'm so deeply grateful. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Brian. Thank you, Mary Meg. Thank you, Jennifer. And of course, thank you, Sylvia. We'll leave it at that. Enjoy this regular Chicago day. There's so much more to come, but please get home safely. And please come visit City Club very soon. Thanks again. Have a great day.